Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Christian witness in an interfaith world. A new joint document from Catholics, Evangelicals and the World Council of Churches aims to stamp out aggressive and coercive missionary activity. And solidarity with South Sudan. As the people there prepare for their Independence Day, we find out why a network of men and women religious is appealing for practical and prayerful support. How to promote Christian witness and mission in a multi-faith context. How to engage sincerely and respectfully with people of other religious traditions. How to stamp out arrogant, aggressive or coercive missionary activities. These questions were at the heart of a new joint document published in Geneva on Tuesday by the World Council of Churches, the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, and the World Evangelical Alliance. The document is the result of 5 years of consultations by some 40 experts in ecumenical and interfaith relations in countries around the world. Entitled Christian Witness in a Multi-Religious World, it contains 12 key principles plus recommendations for local churches seeking to overcome conflicts that arise as a result of aggressive missionary activities. Amongst those speaking at the joint launch in Geneva was Cardinal Jean-Louis Thauron, president of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. He told me about the achievements and the challenges of drawing up a document of this kind.
First of all, I think at the beginning it has to be defined the kind of document we were drafting. At the end, we realized that it was not a theological document, but a more or less a very practical code of conduct. And so after that, we had problems with our theological traditions. We had problems in formulating concepts which have to be agreed by all the religious partners. So it was not very, very easy. But it has been a kind of pilgrimage, and I think everybody now is very pleased with the baby.
So a significant achievement. What are the most important points, do you feel? What is the most important area of agreement here?
Well, I think what is important that we are in a plurireligious world, Christians realize there are many things in common. More than points that divide us, there are very common points. And this is very important that religions, and especially Christianity, appears like not a source of division, but a source of solidarity and spiritual communion. Because when believers are around the table and they share their views, they try to understand each other, I think that it is a great service they give to society because it shows that it is possible to live diversity in unity.
So would you say the document is aimed at parish level, at religious leadership, or at governments also, talking about the need for religious freedom?
Well, government, I hope, but surely we have to emphasize the importance that these principles be known and applied at the grassroots level of our community.
If you're talking about countries where religious conflicts are very common, how easy do you think it is to implement the principles of this document?
First of all, when we are in a country where there is a persecution against Christians, of course, it's very difficult to implement all the principles that are written there, but at least some of them, like human solidarity, like freedom of cult, at least of worship, at least. But what is important to always realize that interreligious dialogue is not dialogue between religions; it's dialogue between believers. So it's a very concrete activity, and of course, the problems also are very, very concrete. For example, the situation in India is not the same as in Africa or in London. So what is important is that all the partners who have drafted this text are committed to proclaim the word of God, and witnessing to the world is essential for every Christian. So it is necessary to do that according, of course, the principles of the gospel. We are not going to, it's not a campaign of aggression, an aggressive campaign. No, it's, on the contrary, a kind of meditation and a code of conduct. It means a program for tomorrow.
There are those, though, who still see a significant tension within the Catholic Church between being open to the experience of others, respecting other religious traditions, and remaining true to the missionary call of the gospel.
Well, I think this is because they don't know exactly what is interreligious dialogue, because the first condition of success in interreligious dialogue is to proclaim, to affirm his own faith. That is, build up interreligious dialogue on ambiguity. So the partners must have a very clear-cut idea of what is their faith. And it is what I say so many times, that when you practice interreligious dialogue, you are obliged to deepen your own faith. Otherwise, it has no sense. For example, if you look at the encyclical of John Paul II on mission called Redemptoris Missio, interreligious dialogue is enshrined in the missionary task of the Church. So it means when you practice interreligious dialogue, you proclaim your own faith. You don't impose it, but you propose it.
What do you hope, then, will be the reaction to this document? Do you think it can be a very practical tool for interreligious dialogue today?
Well, it depends of the bishops now and the parish priest. And, of course, we have to do a great effort in order to make it easily attainable for the parishes and schools and Catholic universities and so on.
Hosting the launch of this new document at the World Council of Churches headquarters in Geneva was Lutheran pastor and WCC General Secretary, Dr. Olaf Fixit-Weidt. He told me this represents a major step forward for the ecumenical movement.
I think this is common understanding that has grown for a while, many churches, but also in these national bodies like ours, that many of the challenges we now have in how we relate to people of other faith, how we do our mission, how do we present our Christian witness, how do we present the gospel so that it is presented with a Christian attitude as well, and not only with the words. My experience as well from Norway was that we actually started a project like this there as well, with other religious partners, actually, to discuss this also from another perspective, namely how do all kinds of religions who want to present their faith do it with a proper respect for the other, and with moral standards that can also have some kind of universal character. And I think what we now do here in this document is to present this particularly from the values of the Christian tradition. I think it really corresponds to many of the common values of many religious traditions.
It's true that it took you 5 years, though, to draw it up, to find something that was acceptable to most people around the table. Would you say that all the partners are now happy with the current statement?
Yeah, as far as I know, we have now developed a level of common understanding, a level of having a text together with precise and, I would say, challenging elements for all of us. But as a common standard for how we think this should be given as recommendations to those who are involved in mission.
What do you see as the most important challenges? You're talking about a challenging document for all concerned.
Well, I think it is quite a challenge for us to present the Christian message in a time when all churches, wherever they are in the world, face an interfaith reality. So I think for many churches it is a way to discover the reality of the other religions, not only as something foreign or something far away, but something we have in our own context. Secondly, I think challenges we face in these themes and addressing these themes is how we make our Christian witness credible, sense that it is an integrated way of presenting our Christian faith, so that also the love and the respect for others and human dignity of everybody, whether they are Christians or not, can as a clear message also, not only in what we say, but also how we say it and how we present it. And I think that is a challenge that is following a Christian witness through the ages, but I think it becomes even more challenging now in a globalized world with strong presence of other faiths.
It's particularly challenging, isn't it, for those countries where there are many situations of interreligious violence and conflict. How do you think this document can in any way help in those particularly difficult contexts?
Well, I just came back from Beirut morning from visiting some of the member churches we have there and other partners. I think, for example, in the Middle East context, the churches have a very strong experience of how to how to be church in a multi-religious context, how to do the mission of the church such a way so that it, over time, build this credibility of the church, being reliable, promoting the values of justice and peace, part of the Christian message, but also giving dignity to every human being, as Christ has called us, follow the great commandment of loving your neighbor as yourself, as basic Christian attitude wherever we are. We have to realize that in areas like the Middle East, particularly the issue of mission, a challenging issue, as many other actors have both come to the region and doing mission in other ways they are used to do it in other parts of the world. I think that has caused some tensions. I think we should be quite open and transparent about that. I hope that this document can really express our common values when we want, as Christians, send our message like in the context of the Middle East.
So it's really an attempt to stop any kind of aggressive proselytizing or forced conversions, really, isn't it?
Certainly, and without saying that we should not send gospel to everybody as a good message to everybody, but really to, as you say, to stop an inappropriate way of doing it, aggressive, provoking, and also to avoid that we don't do it in an ecumenical way, not being part of a fellowship with the local churches where we are working. And I think that is one of the great issues which we need to address together now, how our Christian witness must be our common witness.
Are there any particular countries that you looked at that are of special concern to you regarding these difficulties, these challenges?
Well, I, as far as I know, the Middle East has been one of those regions where several churches have brought these issues to us, the World Council of Churches. I know also that there have been several discussions about mission and evangelism in former Eastern Europe reality, and as the Iron Curtain was disappearing and many countries were then opened again for mission and for a Christian witness, and that it has become a problem for the present churches who have been there for years and for centuries, how to deal with what they find as also proselytizing from their own flocks. I think those questions we are dealing with here are not only relevant between Christian churches and other groups of other faiths. It's also a matter of other as Christian churches.
Have you had consultation on this with members of other faiths?
As I say, I have from my background had it. I think those who have been involved in this process are those who are really almost day-to-day dealing with institutions and people of other faiths. So I think this reflects quite a lot of these sections which have been going on for years.
The document contains many excellent principles. The challenge, of course, is how to implement these, especially in situations like, for example, the Middle East or other areas where Christians are persecuted, for example.
I think we now need to reflect on exactly how this can be recommendations relevant for concrete situations. I mean, this has become a document that has a kind of global character. The great challenge is bring it back also then to every relevant and concrete situation where these questions need to be addressed. I hope that this document really can foster that will happen in different contexts.
My thanks there to Dr. Olaf Fixet-Weidt, the General Secretary of the World Council of Churches. And earlier you heard Cardinal Jean-Louis Torrent, President of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. With just a few days to go before the Republic of South Sudan officially becomes the newest nation in the world, a network of Catholic religious is appealing for solidarity and support for the people in one of the poorest parts of our planet. South Sudan, in fact, ranks at the bottom of the UN's Quality of Life Index for the world's 193 countries. The illiteracy rate there stands at 85%. The vast majority of people live well below the poverty line, and one in every four children dies before the age of five. That's why this international network of men and women religious, Solidarity with South Sudan, is calling for support of all kinds, financial, advocacy, awareness raising, or prayers, as they seek to rebuild, empower, and reconcile a people emerging from half a century of civil war. At a press briefing hosted by the Australian Embassy to the Holy See here in Rome last week, the director of the network, Loreto's sister Pat Murray, told me more about the organisation and about the pressing needs of the people in South Sudan.
This came from an appeal by the retired Bishop of Tomboroyambio, Bishop Gassi. He came to Rome in 2004, I think, or early 2005. And he asked members of religious orders here in Rome, would they come to see the state of South Sudan after the end of the Second Civil War, after decades of civil war, really. And that appeal came to the unions of superiors general men and women. There are two of these unions. And they decided to send a delegation to South Sudan in March 2006. And I was one of the people who went on that delegation to see the state of the country after so many years of war.
You were deeply shocked by what you saw, weren't you?
I was deeply shocked and deeply moved by, because when you sit for over a month in villages and towns, under trees, wherever you meet people, and you listen to stories and you listen to truth-telling from every quarter in society. I remember a young man saying to me, you know, I've been taught how to make war. Will somebody come and teach me how to make peace? I heard the anger of women who felt that their menfolk hadn't been protective of them. They had been raped and their villages had been burnt. They'd been pillaging. You heard about long years running in the bush from various militia groups, years spent in camps for internally displaced people or over the borders. Like, I mean, one of the frightening statistics was that everybody in South Sudan had been displaced at least once. And some people would tell you stories of being displaced not once or twice or three times, but many times. I remember somebody saying we were branded like cattle. In some camp, in some kind of type of concentration camp they had been held. So the stories and the suffering was horrific, but the people were just so grateful that now the world was beginning to hear their story, hear that 2 million nearly had been killed and many million had been displaced. And that was only in 2006, when you think of it. I've often said to people I considered myself well-read and informed internationally, but I had never heard of South Sudan. I'd never heard, wasn't aware of the struggle. So you began to realise that if the media don't pick up on parts of the world where there's slaughter and war and conflict happening, then it can pass by. And that's the challenge, I think, to all of us, to focus on areas and maybe areas off the map, because, you see, it was very difficult to get to South Sudan. You had to either come up from Nairobi or down from Khartoum. And both, it was only the very brave managed that journey. And a lot of the people, in a sense, who were there were church people, different Christian groupings. But they were expelled by the northern government twice in the 60s and then again in the 80s. So the number of expatriate people who were there to know what was going on the ground were very few.
5 years on, your organisation, Solidarity with Southern Sudan, has managed to achieve an extraordinary amount, hasn't it, given all the difficulties that you faced?
It has, and I think that shows you the strength of collaboration. I mean, there are over 170 religious congregations contributing in some way to this initiative. We've been able to form partnerships with funders, sometimes governments, donor agencies. We're also partnering with peacekeeping organisations, with networks who are advocating for peace and development. We also make contact with people who pray. I mean, many of our members are in our congregations. You have many elderly sisters, priests and brothers who really do make Southern Sudan and the whole of Sudan the object of their prayer. And I think that kind of collaborative force, we underestimated. Like, we've been able, I mean, you can look at the statistics and say, isn't it wonderful? We're training over 1,000 teachers. We've built 2 teacher training colleges, which are just about to open and train new teachers. We have renovated a huge health training centre in Wau, and we're training the first state registered nurses there, and we'll soon begin to train midwives there. We've lots of pastoral programmes for women and youth and so forth. But I look at all that and I mean, I'm amazed. We've only 25 people on the ground and yet this is what we've achieved collaboratively. But I'm also amazed at the generosity of the South Sudanese, the welcome, the collaboration they've given. Like, we're trying to do it together, doing it with the local church, doing it with the Sudanese on the ground who are in in various organisations, church organisations or governments or the local chiefs or whoever. I mean, this is a partnership at many different levels. And I think that's its beauty. And also, we're not going... the tradition way a religious order would have gone would have... You'd go and you'd go to set up a community in a school or a clinic and be there for hundreds of years, maybe. We're going to finish. In other words, we know this project will last about 15 to 20 years. And by that time, we hopefully will have trained local people to take over and run all these programmes and projects. And it's theirs. In fact, they're already theirs. It's just the capacity isn't there to take them over at this stage. We're doing it on behalf of the local people, the local church.
You're helping these people as they start a new chapter of their journey, if you like. After so many decades of war, they're now looking at a new nation. The needs are absolutely enormous, aren't they?
When people say, what do you need in Sudan? I just say everything and everybody. Anybody who can come, anybody who can give whatever you can, or from wherever, your support, your interest, your encouragement. Your encouragement, too, of South Sudanese who are living in different parts of the world. Encourage them to come home and help build a new nation. Because literally, there's almost nothing there in terms of infrastructure. Like in 2005, I often use the figure, South Sudan is the size of France and Germany combined. There was only, I think, 70 kilometres of paved road. So roads have had to be built. And the United Nations and the international community has played a big role in trying to develop the infrastructure. But schools, clinics, hospitals, everything. That whole infrastructure that we take for granted in other countries. You know, the existing teachers, only 7% have had any training whatsoever. And they need 26,000 new teachers. Again, one nurse for every 20,000. In the hospital in Wau, there are 204 nurses, of whom 4 are trained. One surgeon for every 300,000. Like, the needs are enormous. And yet the people just say, we want clean water, we want food, agriculture, we want food sustainability, we want a school for our children, and we want a clinic to go for too. Their needs are kind of the very basic needs that you want to give for shelter and water and healthcare. And I suppose I appeal to everybody, the organisations, but also individuals. You know, our small donations can make a huge difference in a place like Sudan.
This is a nation, or these are people who have been living on handouts, on charity for decades, haven't they? Yet you're trying to instill, you're trying to build a new sense of nationhood, a new sense of self-reliance.
Yeah. Like one of the things, we're training nurses, just to give you an example in Wau, and I say to them, yes, you could get very well trained here and then go to Kenya and Uganda and earn big salaries, but we're pleading with you, go back to your villages. Help your people who have nothing. So you're having to build with the young people, particularly that you're training, a sense of obligation to the nation. I learned that in my own life because my parents were working for the government in a new Ireland when Ireland became independent. And I, at a young age, I learned what a sense of social responsibility to building a new nation, what it looks like. And it's a big challenge, and many won't be able for it because their daily needs are so acute. But there are many who will be able for it. And therefore, for young men and women, we're putting this challenge. The new nation needs you, needs your skills, needs your competencies, needs your values, needs your commitment. Make this choice rather than a big salary. Because one of the things is we train people sometimes in some of our institutions, and then they leave us and they go to the local NGO because there's a better wage. So you're trying to encourage people to make the kind of choices that are pro their country.
Another big question is that around peace building, reconciliation, conflict resolution between the many different tribal allegiances, as well as, of course, religious differences there too. And you're working on this, aren't you?
We're working with others on that. And particularly, we're supporting the work of the Christian churches, who have played an enormous role in many peace conferences and peace initiatives in different parts, particularly of South Sudan, where they've brought tribes who have long histories of conflict. Often it's around land or water. The agriculturalists versus the pastoralists, or cattle raiding for bride price. And the Christian leaders have done wonderful work with the local traditional chiefs in developing processes of reconciliation, which involve local customs, local ways of peacemaking as well as Christian ways of peacemaking.
For example?
They have a custom, say, for example, of slaughtering an animal, using the blood of an animal when you are making peace. And some of those, and particularly in some cases, I think it's a white bull that has to be slaughtered. So the Christian churches will use those local traditional rituals, but also build prayer, build testimony, build statements of regret. I mean, I've seen the texts of some of these where the local people will admit their wrongdoing. More recently, when we had a campaign called 101 Days of Prayer for a Peaceful Referendum in Sudan, we witnessed in Wau a wonderful ceremony where people of different tribes and different religious groups came together. And they had a wonderful ritual in the central square, in Freedom Square. And they were all asked to write on a piece of paper ways in which, first of all, they had offended their neighbour and where they were asking for forgiveness. And then to write also ways in which they had felt offended and oppressed. And these were burnt symbolically, so that you were trying to cleanse yourself of what evil does, both the evil that you do or we do to one another and the evil that's done to us. I mean, that can be a crippling force. And obviously, as Christians, we regard it as a grace to be able to do that. It's almost the divine power and the divine work of God in helping us to take that step, A, to ask for forgiveness, and B, to give forgiveness. Because any of the spiritual writers will tell us it's only the victim can actually take that step. Forgiving the other, forgiving the person who has done the wrong. And in that act, both are freed in a new way.
You're talking about the enormous role of the Christian churches there in the south. Of course, over the decades, there have been conflicts, Muslim-Christian conflicts, of course, with the northern government being a largely Muslim population. Is this still a critical problem or not?
Well, in a sense, I think it's a bit like other parts of the world where religion is used politically. The differences are exploited, any differences, and therefore one of the differences is the Christian-Muslim division. I mean, it remains to be seen what will happen to the north, and will it become, how will the north develop its own constitution when it becomes when north and south separate, and also the role of religion in the northern state. In the south, it's interesting, they almost want a non-religious state. They're almost making the other mistake of excluding religion because they've seen the effects of religion. So, for example, the Christian leaders were not included in the framing of the new constitution. Now, I think it's an interim document, but it was, I think, a mistake. You need to allow all the parties, including the religious voices, to participate. But they're being so careful because they've seen how religion was used to manipulate people. However, on the ground, you know, the relations between Christians, Muslims, animists, others, is actually the relationship of neighbours, of people too who are surviving, and who often are exploited by different groups. But during the lead up to the referendum, there was a big group in the south of Muslims for separation. So it was to show that you can't easily categorise. It's too easy to put people in categories and to stereotype people. And I think that's one of our challenges in today's world, that we don't say, well, we see Christian, it means X, and Muslim, and it means Y. That's too simplistic. We're basically all people. We've a religious tradition that's important, and it's a heritage, and it's part of what makes us who we are, part of our identity, an important part of identity. But that respect for the different identities, like down in Juba, you have the call to prayer from several mosques. So that's a very healthy sign, you know, the Christians and Muslims living alongside each other.
My thanks there to Loreto Sister Pat Murray, head of Solidarity with South Sudan. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.